I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high and canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa.
Good evening, Vashon Island. I am Megan Hastings, and this is the Cats and Jammer Follies, a travel story show. Today, we have a very special guest, a dear friend by the name of Martin Fevrier, or Fevrier, we like to call, both ways. He's a singer, actor, record producer. He was a tour manager and a sound engineer for so many rock bands and is an all-around man of the rock and roll. Martin is a very interesting person and has so many amazing tales. And he's going to share with us a bit of yourself and your career, but most of all, your travels.
Hi, Megan.
Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me here.
Oh my God, are you kidding? It's my pleasure.
It's a gorgeous day. I know this is going out at nighttime, but it's gorgeous.
And who knows when?
Who knows when?
The mystery of radio.
Yeah, the mystery of radio. That's right.
Martin, you've had quite a long career in many different aspects of the arts. How did you, what was your initial, you went to art school?
I went to art college in the UK in Ipswich, which is, I believe it's the same art college that Brian Eno went to, because he was from Woodbridge, which was a little town about 3 or 4 miles from Ipswich. And I also heard a rumor that Adolf Hitler went to that same art college.
Is that actually true?
Adolf Hitler went to art college in England, yeah.
Oh, I knew he went to art school, but I didn't realize that it was in England.
I believe so. Oh. I think he went to Liverpool, and I think he might have gone to Ipswich. Yeah.
How far is that from London?
It's about 65 miles northeast, which by American standards is the other end of the world.
Yeah, countries are very different.
It's very different. I remember, you know, when I was in a band in, in the 80s. And, you know, I talked to my friends.
What was the name of your band in the 80s?
I'm not telling you.
Come on,
I'm not
Martin.
Telling you. Okay, so when I was 15, I built my first synthesizer. I glued my bangs, actually, my fringe, to the keyboard accidentally. So I had to cut a few inches of my very valuable Human League fringe off, which is so sad.
I bet it was hot.
I mean, it was
Martin.
Sad to cut the fringe off.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, that's what I mean.
You know, you earn it.
I had a tail back then.
You had a tail.
Oh, yeah. All different crazy.
Did you see?
Characters.
I had the asymmetrical kind of like, you know, long on one side, short on the other.
Oh, I know it well.
Yes. Of course you did.
I used to have a shaved head with just a little bit up here, like kind of not unlike a skin bird, although I was
a
not
skin bird.
A skin bird.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah.
A skinhead.
So then I had a flat top, you know, like a kind of flat top.
Yeah.
But my bangs were about, you know, 14 inches long, and I used to like comb them up and spray them over the top. But if the wind caught it, it would look like I had a big L shape of hair, like above my head.
Did you do that with hairspray or did you use egg wash? Because I know I used a lot of egg wash.
It was gel. And then hairspray. Mm-hmm.
Nice.
My mom's hairspray. So it would just be like, oh, Marty, you've used up all my hairspray. Bloody hell. Right?
Yeah, I can hear it. I've heard you use her voice before, and I really always enjoy it.
Thank you. It's the only way. That's the way I reconnect with my dear old mom who's not around anymore.
I wish I could
have met
her.
Boy, we got off tangent really quickly,
yeah,
didn't we?
We did, but we're going to go back.
Yeah, that's okay. That's okay. Yeah, so my first band.
What's the name, Martin?
The first band I had was called Linkage, would you believe?
Linkage.
Linkage. Yeah, terrible name.
What does that mean?
You know, like, it was like, it's just about being, about connective stuff.
Oh.
It was kind of like electronic and, you know.
I sang and played
really bad synthesizer. We were just like a really crappy Depeche Mode mixed with OMD. You know?
I didn't know that Depeche Mode could ever be crappy.
Well, if they had their crappy moments,
it would have been linkage.
Our very best moments were not as good as Depeche Mode's crappiest moments.
Wow.
Yeah. And then we were called, then I had a band called All the Rage for about 2 years, which is better, I think.
That's a good name. I like that.
And then I had a band called 1,000 People for about 8 years.
Were you guys signed? Did you tour?
We were not signed.
This was still in England.
Oh yeah, yeah. I was in my first band in 1983.
It's quite some time ago now.
Long time ago. seems like yesterday though.
Doesn't it? All those memories.
I pushed so many of them aside.
So tell us, Martin, how is it that you became a tour manager? And because you had your own band, so how did it?
So it's kind of a long story. You know, it's part of the kind of chronology of the travel, my experiences with travel.
Mm-hmm.
I can get onto that maybe a little later if I start at the very beginning. You know, like maybe.
Yeah, we want to hear it all.
Yeah, so. You know, as you might tell, I do not come from, you know, classy English stock. You
well,
know.
Martin.
Yeah.
Nobody would know that.
Yeah, well.
Because anyway. We all think of you as classy in English.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Right, right. Well, thank you.
All the ladies on Vashon fall for Martin and his fancy accent.
Yeah, right. Right. Oh, thank you very, very, very much. It's so kind of you to think of me that way.
Oh, we do. We all love you.
No. So I grew up in a little town called Hadley. It's a, you know, basically an Anglo-Saxon village, not too far from the coast, about 15 miles in from the coast in East Anglia. And
sounds beautiful.
It is absolutely gorgeous. In fact, there's parts of Vashon that really remind me very much of Suffolk.
Oh.
Except in Suffolk, people's eyes are closer together. The families, just to say the families are a little closer.
I knew what you meant by that.
Yeah, okay, good.
Some inbreeding at its finest on the English coast.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, exactly. As they say, yes, I'm into bread, but I'm also into the Beatles, and I'm also into Chicago.
The never band mind. Chicago.
Yeah, never mind. Into bread.
That's the worst
bread.
Band.
It's a band called Bread.
Never yeah, mind. Yeah, okay. I know it.
Anyway, so... yeah, beautiful part of England. And I grew up on a housing estate, council estate. You know,
explain that
for a lot
for
of
people that don't
okay,
know.
Yeah,
what
so
that is.
In the 19, it's like a post-war. So you know, the late 40s, early 50s, the British government decided or realized. Because it's not about like, okay, we're going to be kind to our people. It's like, well,
post-World War II and England got bombed out.
Bombed out. But also too, there was this, you know, understanding, and America's slowly coming toward, you know, I think coming towards that only, you know, 70 years later, that if you don't have a populace that is, you know, reasonably well educated, not hungry, physically somewhat secure in their housing, not too concerned about being homeless,
mm-hmm.
maybe not concerned about the quality of their life, or the quality of their housing, but they do have housing and reasonably healthy. You can't have a good, reliable
society.
Workforce
yeah.
because that's what capitalism demands is it demands a workforce that is educated enough and capable enough and stable enough to actually work.
Absolutely.
And also to be consumers. Because if you're not a good, if you're not either a worker or a consumer, you're no good to a capitalist society, which, you know, England has been for many, many, many years. So they realized that they introduced a huge program of building, you know, millions of houses around the UK.
And they were subsidized by the government.
Paid for totally by the government.
So would you not have a rent to pay?
Yes, oh, you'd have a rent.
But just very, very low.
Fairly low. Now it's actually not low. I'm amazed at how high the rents are on council houses now. It's kind of crazy. But back then, you know.
Well, but England in general is so expensive.
Yeah, it is very expensive now.
So when you were there, did you, you lived out your whole time as a youth?
I grew up in Hadley, yeah, until I was 18.
I mean, in this council housing.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, on the same street.
Is your dad still
road.
There?
Yeah, on the actually, the house I was born in, we lived in until I was about five. And then because it had a bigger yard, a disabled family was given that house and they built an extension for them. And we moved down the road.
So to
same
a smaller
road,
one.
Smaller house, yeah. Same road, though. And I, but like most people, when you grow up and you don't see, you don't really see anybody that's from out of your, you know, social network, your part of town,
sure.
You tend to think, well, that's what the rest of the world is like. You know, and back then
you
didn't
do.
Have the kind of news and movies and all this kind of thing to give you a more cosmopolitan view of the world. Or,
yeah, there was
or,
no MTV.
No, there was no, or anything, you know, like,
yeah.
You know, like, you know, you got short news.
I only
you,
said that as that was sort of like the first thing that, like, when we were kids, where you'd be like, oh, that person's wearing that. That's so cool. Like pre-internet, it was like, that was the one thing that you looked to.
Yeah, because we got all of our news and influences as kids and youth from, you know, the TV, radio, and press. There was no other way to get it.
Top of the Pops, maybe?
Top of the Pops, yeah. Big deal. Thursday
big
night.
Deal.
Thursday night, everybody. Next day at school, did you see?
Coronation
yeah,
Street.
Oh, no, that's too depressing for me.
I'm joking.
Yeah, that was for the Northerners. So we, you know, we lived on this council estate, and looking back at it, you know, I see what was going on, but at the time I was a little embarrassed because you know, we had an old motorbike with a sidecar on, and that was the way we got around. We didn't have a car. That was the way we got around. So at the time it was kind of embarrassing for me, particularly as I got a little older. But my dad was involved in the sidecar club association there in the UK. And, you know, through the summer, nearly every weekend, there'd be camping meets. So we did a lot of traveling. And if you think about this, you know, this is late 60s, early 70s. Most working class people in the UK did not have a car.
No, oh, yeah, I can
didn't,
totally
didn't. And in America,
that.
You know, that was probably could be said in the, you know, late 50s. So we're talking 20 years later.
Right.
And, you know, that situation's happening in the UK. But although it was a little embarrassing when I look back at it, now I'm like, actually, we were really lucky.
Yeah,
because
it was
we got away
it.
A lot of weekends in the summer. Now, we didn't do a great many interesting things, but we went to some cool places.
Is this why you have a sidecar motorcycle now?
Partly.
Yeah.
It takes me back to that. And it's just fun. I mean, it's a unique way to get around. And it's not like sitting in a car.
It's great to see Martin and he has a couple of children and a beautiful wife. And it's always fun to see them on this bike.
Yeah, we have an old BMW with a sidecar.
Yeah.
But the motorbike that we had when I was a kid, I have that now here on Vashon, the green Sunbeam. That's the motorbike that my mom and dad had. Or my
oh,
dad
wow,
had two
really?
Sunbeams. Yeah. My
oh,
dad
I didn't
had two Sunbeams.
That.
Yeah. And what he would do is he would, you know, restore one, then run it into the ground while he was, you know, with a sidecar on. And then while he was running that one into the ground, he would be kind of restoring another one, rebuilding that engine. And he would kind of basically trade the sidecar off every 5 or 6 years or something onto the other bike.
That's
restore
amazing,
the other
Martin.
One. And the bike that I have right now, I think he paid £5 for it.
Oh.
The guy wanted the gentleman wanted 10, and my dad talked him down to 5 because I think it had been laying in a ditch or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah. So
that's
how
cool.
We got around. That was my first eye opening to travel and seeing parts of England that culturally weren't that much
accessible.
Different. They weren't accessible. They weren't that much different, but there was, you know, language differences and some cultural differences and a few food differences, which are, you know, any when you're young and you get introduced to anything new, I mean, it's amazing. One of my earliest memories of actual travel is which I'm amazed that my dad actually took us was we drove from Suffolk, Southeast England, all the way up to Liverpool, which, like, you know, even by English standards, is definitely the other end of the world.
Right.
That's Northeast England, just, you know, basically almost close to Scotland. And we took the ferry to the Isle of Man to go to the Isle of Man TT races, which is, if people don't know, it's the tourist trophy. It's the motorcycle races. They close down the whole island of the Isle of Man, and these insane races happen every year. And I remember,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I remember I was four, and I remember being in the sidecar and being on a ferry, because that was a totally new experience, and meeting a family who looked different from us. They were all blonde, you know.
Yeah.
And realizing they're from a different country. First time I'd ever met someone from a different country.
Where were they from?
They were from Holland. And I remember, like, making friends with their children, like picking my head out the sidecar and talking to their children.
And they spoke English.
A little bit.
Yeah.
And that was just, like, you know, wondrous. It was just like magic. And then going to the Isle of Man and hiding behind these cobblestone walls while these, and the smell of the two-stroke engines, like, you know, these racing motorcycles.
What beautiful
just
memories you have.
Blowing around that island, you know, being kind of scared, but hiding behind these cobblestone walls.
Wow.
You know?
That's really cool.
Yeah. So those are probably my earliest actual travel memories.
And it's interesting when you, like, are able to travel as a young person, if it's something that agrees with you, it literally is such a driving force throughout a life. Like, the first time I ever traveled, I was 14. I mean, just like really traveled. And then just for my whole entire life, that's all I've wanted to do.
Yeah.
Is like just go and see and meet people and taste things and just experience life.
Yeah.
For me, it is
those cultural things.
Yeah.
You know, the food and the visual side of things, the weather, the terrain, the texture. But for me, it's also the people thing that I love.
It's the people.
It's the people.
It's 100%.
And what I am grateful for, although I didn't quite realize it, and, you know, my mom and dad are not adventurous socially at all.
Mm-hmm.
My dad, absolutely not.
Well, it's a good thing that he had a hobby with the motorcycle.
Exactly. You know, and it was really, I think, in pursuit of his interests,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we would go to these places and there would never be anything to do. And, you know, you just run around with the kids and, you know, roll around the mud and throw apples at each other or whatever you could find, or, you know, drink Scrumpy and
what's,
you know,
Scrumpy?
So the big sidecar rally every year was held down in Somerset, which is southwest of England. So everyone knows you speak like that down there, like, you know, down in Somerset.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
I know that accent.
Down in Somerset. Down in Somerset. And you could walk around, you know, while the grown ups are doing their thing, you know, talking about, you know, steering dampers and things like that, and, you know, what size is your rear wheel, you know, whatever. As kids, we would just, like, you know, bugger off and wander around, and, you know, you'd see these signs at these little farms. It would say, like, a gallon of Scrumpy, 50 pence, you know, which is a gallon of apple cider.
Oh, so Scrumpy is apple cider. Oh, my God. I like that
name.
I think we should adopt that on Vashon.
We would just get trounced. You know, we were kids, and, you know, you weren't, no one supervised you. You know, you just, like,
drink gallons
of
Scrumpy.
You take swigs off this stuff, and, you know, you'd have the runs for like 3 or 4 days, you know. but you'd have a very merry time.
I bet you would.
You know,
would.
So those were good memories, for sure. You know, I have memories of my first interaction with someone in America was just, you know, the American person was maybe being 6 or 7. And, you know, the motorcycle was very underpowered, you know, it's 24 horsepower. So I had my mom and dad on the bike, me and my sister in this big sidecar side by side with a dog in the front, and then camping gear packed in the back and a trailer with the tent and
the trailer off the motorcycle,
towed behind the motorcycle.
Like too much weight.
I don't know what my dad was thinking, but he did it. And so we, you know, I remember stopping in this little village, or us going through this little village, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, whatever, and going around this corner, we have to slow down. And then there being a really steep hill. And my mom, you know.
And you'd all have to get out and push.
Yeah, my mom would, like, get out and effing push. And we'd have to jump out the sidecar and, like, push the motorbike. And I remember some American, you know, person going like, oh, gee, how quaint. And my dad going, F off, you know. Because there's nothing quaint about it.
There's nothing quaint
nothing
about that.
Quaint
no.
About it.
No, but I could see an American being like, oh, look at that nice little English family.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, look, they push their motorcycles uphill.
Exactly. And I wonder if they have electricity over here, you know. But it was a lot of that travel was boring as hell. I mean, it was just you're sitting in a sidecar, just like looking, and it's noisy, and it's not that comfortable, you know,
noisy.
Sitting beside an old vintage motorcycle, whatever, you know, at maximum 30 miles an hour.
Rattle your insides.
Yes. Yeah. It was. And what really helped was that I think this would have been 1978. So I was 11, 12. My dad put in a cassette player in the sidecar with, you know, horrible tiny little speakers. But that meant we could play music.
What would you guys listen to?
Well, we had one cassette with one song on it. And it's the Bee Gees, Tragedy.
This is the song.
This
right
is
here.
The song.
That you would hear over.
Yeah. And
over.
Me and my sister would just sing at the top of our voices.
Oh.
Yeah. Over and over again.
That's sweet.
And I'm not going to sing it now.
How many times do you think that you heard that song, Martin?
Well, I think probably thousands of times when I was 11 or 12 years old. But I actually haven't heard that song in full in probably 35 years until just now.
Till just
well,
now.
Well, that's not even in full, but that's enough.
Well, it's fully enough.
Yeah. We had enough.
Yeah,
we had enough.
It's a pretty good song.
It's a great song. It's a great song.
It's kind of funny that of all the Bee Gees songs, that's the one that your dad would have gotten.
Oh, he
cassette.
Didn't. I think we probably taped it off the radio. Because my dad was, you know, I don't know what my mom thought of my dad. Well, my mom was actually head over heels in love with my dad. But, you know, she met him in 1964, you know, in Dover. And she was, you know, 16 and a rock and roll girl. And my dad was into Al Jolson and Glenn Miller.
Really?
Yes.
I could see that. I've met your dad.
Yeah, but I mean, if you think about it, he was, what 22 at the time. I mean, what 22-year-old?
Oh, he was that much older than your mom?
Well, maybe he was 19. Yeah, no, but actually about 19. I guess he was 19. Yeah.
I was going to say 22 to 16. Ooh, scandal.
Well, back then, that's fine because, you know, in England, the age of consent.
Is it 16?
Yeah, probably then it was 15.
Then it
was 15, yeah. Yeah. And you know the rule, you know, it's like the speed limit. You can go 10 miles an hour over. Well, with the age of consent in England, you can go a couple of years under. And it's totally acceptable.
Yeah, I'm sure it is here.
Totally
too.
Acceptable.
I don't know that it's acceptable by most, but, you know.
Well, in the 60s, probably.
I remember when I was a kid.
What do you mean? It's legal to marry a 12-year-old in Arkansas, isn't it?
Oh, God. I remember when I was a kid, I was like 15, and I had met some guy who was like 25 at like a rock concert, and he called me, and my dad answered the phone, and he could tell he was like older, and he hung up, and he was like, "That's not what you need." Just like kept walking. I never even got to talk
and
to
Megan
the guy.
And Megan was like, "Actually, this is just exactly what I need."
But he was hot. What do you mean?
Yeah, he was
Come
hot.
On.
He's got his own car and a mullet. He's got a Camaro and a mullet.
A bitchin' Camaro at that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Of course he did.
Maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so, you know, of course, then when I reached my you know, that 13, 14 age, no, was I ever going to go anywhere with my parents? No way in hell. You know, you do anything you can to get out of a really boring camping weekend. So I, you know, started staying at home.
By yourself?
Yes,
would your sister stay?
My sister and I, yeah, we would stay at home. And they'd go camping. And then we, you know, sometimes hold parties and things like that. That
sure.
As you do.
Why wouldn't
as
you?
As you do. And, you know, and that I started to get obviously much more into music and making my own music. And I had a band
And being
for,
independent.
Yeah. And being independent, like most teenagers should be. Sadly, that's hard nowadays with COVID. Really hard for teenagers.
I feel so for the kids right now.
You know, that point of their lives where they should be getting out, traveling, going to new towns, maybe going to college if they're lucky enough, and all these things, and making all those mistakes, and flirting, and falling in love, and having your heart go crazy, and then getting dumped, and all those things. Yeah,
I know.
Can't happen now.
It's really hard.
Well, you still get dumped, but it's going to be via text or something.
Or Zoom.
Or Zoom.
Via Zoom meeting. Zoom. Dump me via Zoom, please.
Please. Please. So, you know, and then I started to focus on, you know, getting obsessed with music. And I had a band. And
what was the first thing that you played?
I played, you know, basically simple keyboards. Simple keyboards, synthesizer stuff. Back then, you know, that pop music of the early 80s, it was mostly because of the technological ability of synthesizers. Most of them could only play single notes and monophonic. You couldn't really play chords on a lot of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And so the nature of that music was dictated by that. So, you know, the music of that time was, the pop music was very complex melodically and rhythmically, but it was all like harmonic through counter melodies and rhythmical stuff. You know, it wasn't chords. It wasn't like, not a lot of chords. It wasn't like guitar music where, you know, you pick it up and you voice a chord and then you've got something that's harmonically complex in its own right, you know, one stroke.
Right.
You had to create all your harmonies through single note instruments layered together. And I learned a lot about arranging and melodic elements that way. And so that was really fun.
And then you would go on to learn other instruments.
Yeah, so I play a little guitar and I can play a little drums and things like that. I can play a little bit of a bunch of things. So I'm not a master of any of those things, but I know enough to write. I play well enough to write my songs and help people, other people write songs.
Mm-hmm.
That experience of being in my own band, because there were no recording studios around, I basically, out of necessity, had to learn to record. So, you know, started recording my band on basic equipment, other people's
this
bands.
Was it 10,000 people or 1,000?
1,000 people.
1,000
people,
yeah.
And in that part of England, there weren't really any recording studios, or very few.
So you stayed in Hadley.
I moved to a town called Ipswich when I was
19. Oh, right, because that's where you went to
18,
college.
19, yes, when I went to college. I trained as a graphic designer and illustrator, which I did that until I was about 22. And then I was able to start getting some work in music, you know, mostly driving gear around for people. And I had a friend that had a PA, so I had a van, drive the PA around, help set it up. And then he'd let me mix a few shows here and there, the opening bands. And then I would get compliments and, you know, and I'd be like, okay, maybe I have some ability here. And some of the recordings I did got some radio play and things like that, where they were just these little indicators, you know, even though I didn't know
of
what
a direction that
I didn't know what a record producer was, but, you know, somehow I guess I was doing it, you know.
Right.
And a friend of mine had a management company. He managed a couple of bands from America that came over to tour in the UK. And I went out with those bands just on the road for maybe a few shows or sometimes a week
or
so.
Are they any bands that we would know?
The Fuzz Tones, who were from LA, kind of gothic, you know, kind of Hammer House of Horror, all Vox guitars. And, you know, they looked like they were...
straight out of Bauhaus?
Yeah, but more like 60s gothic psychedelia.
Okay.
You know, and then a couple of bands from Europe, and I did some short touring and realized that
you liked it.
I liked it. So I mostly was driving, you know, these little vans and
driving bands around.
Yes,
bands and equipment.
Yeah. And occasionally doing some sound, you know, getting my fingers wet with audio.
Yeah.
And so I had a friend who had driven a band around Europe. And decided he was going to make his own little tour bus. And he got an old Dodge milk van,
oh,
milk delivery
cool.
van. We called it the Milk Wagen. And it was diesel. And what he did, though, which is great, is he put the seat mounts in backwards. So the seats leant forwards and not backwards. So they're really uncomfortable. It's really hard
I
to stay
imagine.
In your seat. They just didn't lean
sound
back
good.
Quite enough. You know what I mean? Like you couldn't relax them. But anyway, a friend of mine, this guy, Darren, I won't give his last name. He called me up. He owned the van. He said, hey, you know, I've been offered to drive this band. They're American. Do you want to do it? And I said, well, how much is it? He said, £25 a day. And I said, no. I said, who are they? He goes, it's the Screaming Trees. I'm like, I don't know who they are. No. So I had a friend who worked at a record store, and I went to see him and said, hey, what does this band sound like? And he played me Screaming Trees album.
And you fell in love.
And I was like, this music's great. And I'd just gone through a divorce. And sorry, Melissa, I was married before. You didn't know that. But
I can't even
sorry,
believe
darling.
There was somebody before
Melissa. I know, but nothing happened though. And so I felt the need to get out of my little town. And this band, the Screaming Trees.
An amazing band.
And a truly amazing band.
Yeah.
Were the most unique people I had ever met in my life. First,
oh,
you know, I'm spending
I can
time
imagine.
With these. I mean, they were the most dysfunctional people I'd ever met as a whole.
And generally, dysfunctional people can be the most entertaining
but fun. The amount of honesty amongst those individuals,
I can't remember, it's a four-piece band, right?
They were a four-piece.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had never seen that before, that really brutal honesty and... there was a sense of like abandon that was really eye opening. Cause I grew up in a pretty safe, very insular, I was a nervous kid, very nervous kid. Mm. And they helped bring my shell out.
So
whenever
you.
I hear that song, this song in particular is the first song off of the album that they were touring on at the time. It just reminds me of travel. It reminds me, I picture movement and new places.
So would have been the first band that you really, really traveled with, like traveled extensively?
Yes.
So all this, throughout Europe?
This was a European tour. And I was just driving.
And what year was this?
92.
92.
June of 92. And so it was just a 6-week tour, but, you know, went everywhere. I mean, and I drove in countries that I'd never driven in before. I'd barely driven on the right before. So that was interesting.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, interesting. And going to all these places back then, you know, Yugoslavia, Rome, you know, where.
Places you'd never been
I'd
to.
I'd never
even.
Been. And,
yeah.
you know.
Had you even ever been out of the UK?
Not much. Not much. Not really.
So really,
I think on a couple
the Screaming
of, you know,
Trees are what got you out of...
It really was. And I kept myself to myself, but I really got along with them. You know, they were...
that raw Pacific Northwest grunge rock, heart on sleeve.
Well, you know, people call them grunge, but if you listen to them, they're got this interesting
well, for lack
mix.
Of a better, of,
lack of a better word. But
sure,
their stuff is so, this record, particularly the Sweet Oblivion record, is such a classic rock record because it's got, you know, you listen to it and it's, you know, it's Stonesy, it's Zeppelin-y, it's, there's bits of kind of Badfinger in there, there's mm-hmm. bits of, you know, psychedelia. I mean, it's got this great mix and it doesn't sound like records of that time. It's really, and of course, Lanigan's voice is like no one else's.
Oh, it's the most, it's perfect voice.
Yeah, he never yarled. He didn't go,
I saw them.
Yep, sure. Or, you know, there was none of that.
Right.
You know.
from Eddie Vedder.
Everyone's been doing it for a long time, you know.
I for sure saw them during this tour, but, you know, in Chicago. And I think it, I want to say that they opened for Alice in Chains.
I was there.
It would have been at the Riviera.
Mm, I was there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Martin and I have a funny thing where we also were together at a different concert in England at the Reading Rock Festival in like 89? I don't know.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Which, wherever Nick Cave played.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, that was probably 92. Was it 92? Because Nick
don't
Cave
remember.
And the Bad Seeds played. So I'll get on to that. So what happened was, you know, I didn't really know who the Screaming Trees were, but they were part of the Seattle explosion. You know?
Oh, 100%.
And so I went from being a little Suffolk boy, you know, playing in my local band and not really, you know, not like wishing to be part of a big music industry. And suddenly I was working with these guys and we were opening festivals for Nirvana. We were doing shows. Oh, yeah. We were doing shows with Nirvana. And they were having... On this European tour, they were having trouble with, not trouble, but they were uncomfortable on stage with the monitors, you know, because every night you go to a different club, different monitor guy, or sometimes not even a monitor guy. So I said, oh, I can do monitors. And they're like, well, how much? And I said, £75 a night, three times what I'm getting paid to drive. And they're like, oh, we can't afford that, but maybe next tour. And I'm like, yeah, right, you know. But after that tour ended, I thought I'd never see them again. And then I got a phone call from their tour manager, Rod Doak. Rod said, hey, Martin, we're doing the Powerhouse and we're doing Reading Festival with Nirvana. Would you come and do monitors? And I said, yes.
Hell yeah.
So I called my friend who owned the PA company and I said, Mick, how the hell do you do monitors? And so I went to his house and, and he showed me a few things, and then boom, I borrowed gear from people, threw it in my van, and drove to Reading. I picked them up from the airport and drove to Reading. And that apparently went okay, because then they called me up a few weeks later and said, hey, we've got this tour coming up with this band called Luna for 6 weeks. Would you come out and do monitors?
Oh, yeah, I remember the band Luna.
Yeah, the guys from Galaxy 500 and whatever.
Were they?
Nice. Yeah, Dean was, the main guy from Galaxy 500.
I haven't heard that
Sweet,
name in
really
a long
nice
time.
Music, kind of like really pretty.
Yeah, very different from happening in Seattle.
Yeah, exactly. They were like that kind of Chicago kind of like, you know.
I don't think they were from Chicago. Though.
Velvet Underground. I think the drummer was from Chicago and Dean. I don't know quite where they're from, probably, you know. New Hampshire or something like that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we did that and I'd only been in the States, I think 3 or 4 days, you know, helping to advance this tour.
So they
tour.
Brought you.
Yeah, over to do stage sound, you know, monitors for them. And we got this message like, oh, Alice in Chains wants to take you out on the Dirt Tour. So we had to, you know, we only ended up doing 2 or 3 weeks of this tour with Luna, or 3 or 4 weeks. And then we went out with Alice in Chains for I think 6 to 8 weeks, and
God,
it was amazing. It was just incredible, like playing these larger venues. And
well, the show that I saw for sure was the size of like the Showbox, if not a little bit bigger.
Probably a little bit bigger. Yeah, we were doing kind of Showbox size through to kind of the Paramount kind of sizes.
Yep, totally.
You know. And that was a real eye-opener for me. But going around these different parts of America that I just, you know, I mean, America is like 20 different countries in one country. It's incredible.
And oftentimes I feel it should be divided up as so.
Well, it is.
Especially with recent politics.
Oh, boy. Yeah. But, you know, as you know, travel and exposure to other cultures is the one thing that changes that for a lot of people.
Oh.
You know, Americans travel within the country quite a bit. I mean, you know, you think nothing of
flying to Vermont
or driving for 6 or 8 hours to go to a show. Whereas in England, you know, I would tell my friends, you know, they'd be like, what you doing tonight? I'm like, playing a show. Where? In London. What, tonight? What, all the way in London? I'd be like, yeah, it's 70 miles. They're like, no, when are you coming back? Tonight. What? From London? Yes. Yes, at 2 a.m, there's no traffic. Don't worry about it. It's a 2-hour drive. You
it's
know?
So true. The countries are so much smaller in Europe that people like, you know, like Genoa to Torino is 1.5 hours, but yet it's they'll never go and see the other places.
So the little village I grew up in England, Hadley, we knew when I was a kid, if someone came into our village from another village 3 or 4 miles away because their accent was different. They said things differently. They used different words. And I remember when I left England, there were still, you know, people my age, people I went to school with, who had not even been to the coast, which was 15 miles away.
Oof.
Never once.
That's not right.
And yeah, but also, you know, that's cultural, and also it's also poverty, because, you know, if if you don't have the money, you're not gonna, if you don't have the money to own a car, even in the 80s, you're not likely to get on a bus going to, you know, Ipswich, and then get another bus to go to the, you know, Felixstowe to walk along the beach and, you know, get some really awful food and get, you know, there's no sand, you know, it's just,
you're just going to stay in your town.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to go back to, you're going to stay in your town. Yeah.
How long did you tour with the Screaming Trees?
Well, when I came to the States, for the first time, I assumed that I was just going to go back to the UK, which I did. I went straight back.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that when they come to Europe next time, they hire me, but for some reason they couldn't. They had to, they work with someone else, and that was okay. But I'd only been back in England a couple of weeks, and my old life just suddenly started to show up again, you know,
life
and wife.
And
I just thought, this is not, I just had these opportunities and these experiences that I'd never had before. And I felt like I didn't really have much to lose. You know, I didn't
own a
house.
Yeah, you might as well just dive right in.
So I bought a ticket, came back to Seattle. I stayed with some friends. I threw my return ticket in the trash.
Did you actually do that?
Yeah, because I just knew
that this, you wanted to be here.
I just knew I had to be here.
And so there are other bands that you've toured with.
Initially, before I was able to, you know, I had some success in making records. Yeah. I mostly toured as a tour manager and did live sound I worked with Green Apple Quickstep. I did a lot of work for the Pearl Jam management people. So, and then, Hammerbox, who were a great band back in the early 90s here. I, toured with this band Grunt Truck, who were actually on that Screaming Trees.
I know that name.
They were, you know, it's pretty basic kind of grungy music, you know, metal-y kind of, but they
were fun
people. I mean, I had a lot of fun. That was great. Yet again, experiences that I'd never had. I'd never been around people who were stimulated or affected by certain, you know, substances before. So I was blind to it. I just thought, whoa, these guys are kind of crazy and energetic or really sleepy, or really bad drunk. I'd never seen it before. So it took me a while to kind of put two and two together and be like, my naivety. I'm sure that's what kept me going, because I drank a fair amount back then, because you can when you're 25, 26.
Yeah, you can.
But it wasn't habitual, you know. So, and I never, you know, after a few early lessons where I made a few mistakes, when I came to the States and I saw that virtually everybody else who was working in touring at that time was either, you know, high or drunk, I thought, I'm going to be the guy that never does that.
And you didn't, because you still don't have
I will, you know, I will have one beer at the end of the night or something like that. Or I might have, you know, a half a beer in the middle of a show while I'm eating my food or something. But I generally don't touch anything
I'm not going to lie. I have seen Martin drunk before.
But not while I'm working.
I'm
working. No, it's true. This past
Halloween, Adam, my husband, and Martin, we all were having cocktails together. And Adam got pretty drunk and decided to take his shorts off and burn them in the fire.
He did. He did. And then
Martin was in full regalia.
Yes. And then, you know, we're all socially distanced, of course.
Yeah, we were.
And then
we were all outside.
So this is a story too. We talk of traveling. When I woke up the next morning, I went out to my car and I saw a bag of Snapdragon, a pound of coffee on the ground, all wet and damp, and that had traveled from Snapdragon. And then I remembered a couple days later that I'd shoved it down the crotch of my trousers to make an impression.
Let's just say Martin is always entertaining us.
Yeah.
Well, I will say this to you as someone who was on the other side of receiving all the wonderful benefits of, you know, Shadow of the Seasons by the Screaming Trees and all the other bands, the Pete Droege and the Presidents of the United States. It was a pretty magical time to be like 18 and 19 growing up and getting to see these bands and all these shows and really getting to rock out.
It was incredible.
It was really an incredible time.
And you know, to think of that, there hasn't really been a cultural musical explosion.
Not like that.
Like this. I mean, you've had, you know, you'll have like, oh, Charlottesville or North Carolina or, you know, New York or Austin is the big, but you know, the Seattle thing lasted a long time, which was unusual
really,
in music.
Really amazing.
And its influence has been long, but also at the same time, we always think of the Seattle grunge thing, but you think, but then you had the Presidents and you've had Death Cab and you've had, you know, every year or two and, you know,
Macklemore and Modest Mouse
and every year or two. So, and Brandi Carlile now, who I've worked with quite a bit. I mean, just, you know, every year or two, some artists have come up out of the Northwest that's just
mind-blowing music.
Mind-blowing, you know. It's pretty amazing.
I think it's all the rain.
I think it's rain and it's also cultural. It's got something to do with rain, but it's also cultural.
Because you're staying home.
Yeah, staying home. Yeah. But it's got something to do, I think, with education and also, you know, there is a kind of a bookwormy thing up here that is probably partly due to the rain. And
absolutely.
You've got to spend your winter months kind of absorbing something and expressing yourself somehow, not through, you know.
Hopefully not through drugs.
Yes.
Martin, as we get ready here to close this up, is there any last final words or stories that you'd like to, the wisdom that you learned on these tour buses?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I could come back in. I have some more detailed stories that might be amusing. But, you know, for me, the move to Vashon has, you know, again, part of traveling, has been so amazing for me. I mean, I can't believe even on the dullest and rainiest and coldest of days, the drive for me from my house down 87th around, you know, KVI and then, I always call it Portage, but you know, through
Ellisport
and, you know, that's the kind of place that when you visit when you're on holiday, you know, every, you know, 5 or 6 years where you get to see something that beautiful, you go, God, I wish I lived here. And I get to live here. And every time I drive around there, regardless of the weather or the conditions, I go, I cannot believe I get to live here because I think about how I grew up and where I grew up. And the thought of even ever owning a house was never on my radar ever, or having a business. Or being in control of the path of my life. I thought I was going to go and work in the factory, just like the plastics factory, just like a lot of other people.
Well, Martin, I'm glad that you didn't, because we love you and your family, and you guys
have been such
a great part to, a great addition to have on this island.
We love it. We feel really at home here. We're really grateful for the welcome that
you guys
given.
Immediately fit right in. You clicked right in with everybody.
It's because everyone's eyes are really close together.
I've been everywhere.
That was good. Thank you, Vashon Island, and thank you, Martin Fevrier, for coming in, and Jeff Hoyt, and everybody that's out there listening. We'll see you the next time, and keep traveling.